Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/arts. Just go to Indeed.com/arts right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/arts. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Midnight has passed, and in the stillness of these hours, the hauntings are never silent. This is Real Ghost Stories Online. After midnight.
You never think twice about a broom leaning in a corner? Not until the night you come downstairs and find it standing upright on the kitchen table, circled by four chairs as if some secret meeting had been in progress, and you were the uninvited guest. That night came later. Before that came the move, our supposed fresh start. I'd had a rough stretch in the last place, strange incidents, a low hum of dread that seeped into every room. When the chance came to share a four-bedroom rental with a classmate, two single mothers pooling our resources, I leapt at it. I arrived with my three kids, Mary, 7, imaginative and chatty, Ty, a serious 5-year-old with a permanent furrow in his brow, and Adam, my youngest, 3 years old, still round-cheeked and shy enough to ask for a nightlight. My classmate had her own 2-year-old Max, 5 children, 2 women, 1 big airy house, large enough to feel almost like a victory. The house had the kind of cheerful, family-friendly layout you see in real estate ads, a high-ceilinged foyer with an open staircase curving up to the second floor, its banisters stretching left and right like welcoming arms. To the left of the stairs, a short hall led to a laundry room, a small bathroom, and a den lined with aging cedar panels that smelled faintly of pencil shavings. The kitchen stretched along the back wall of the house, sun bright by day. On the opposite side were the dining and living rooms that framed the foyer. In daylight, it looked like the sort of house where crayon drawings belonged on the fridge, where the scent of bread or soup might linger after dinner. Nothing about it warned us. We settled in fast. My roommate picked up night shifts at a local club. I ran the bedtime routine. Herding 4 kids upstairs, getting them scrubbed, pajamaed, then tucked beneath blankets after a round of bedtime stories. When they were finally down, the whole house exhaled into a hush that felt earned. That's when I started my second shift, my nightly loop with broom and mop. I'd sweep the first floor in one continuous circuit, foyer to laundry to den through the long kitchen, circling back across the dining and living rooms until I ended at the foyer again. The mop and bucket went back into the laundry closet, safely out of Max's reach. Then I'd click off the lights and climb upstairs to work on my laptop. For a few weeks, it was as ordinary as I'd hoped, comfortably, gratefully ordinary. But ordinary houses can keep secrets, and sometimes the quiet is the invitation they've been waiting for. The first crack in the facade came late one night. I was upstairs tapping at my keyboard when a crash exploded somewhere below. Loud, sharp, deliberate. Not the pop of a heating duct or the thud of a settling beam. Stopped me cold. I snatched up my phone and called a friend who lived nearby, whispering as though the house might be listening, asking her to stay on the line. Step by slow step, I descended the staircase. Each board gave a protesting creak, and suddenly the elegant banister felt less like protection and more like a barrier keeping me from escape. The foyer was empty. The side door near the laundry was still locked, and the silence down there was heavy enough to taste. I turned my head toward the den and past that the shadowed length of the kitchen and froze. Tiny metallic glints littered the hall floor ahead of me. I crouched to see what they were. Nail clippers, a pair of scissors, tweezers, several small nail files. All of them scattered as if thrown in a fit of rage. Their plastic container, normally perched on the kitchen windowsill, lay cracked open against the far wall as though it had been pitched from across the room, flinging its contents outward into the hall. I flicked on the kitchen light and my stomach tightened. Every single chair had been lifted from the floor and placed on top of the table. Not upside down like you do for mopping, upright, facing inward, arranged in a perfect circle like four invisible people had sat down for a meeting. In the middle of that circle rested the mop bucket. The mop handle was jammed upright against the ceiling, wedged so tightly it bowed slightly. And on the counters, every cup, plate, bowl, and utensil we owned was lined up as though for inspection. The faint smell of pine cleaner still hung in the air, now mixed with a cold, metallic edge that prickled the hair on my arms. A wave of dread rolled over me, an old dread, the exact bone-deep terror I'd felt in the last house, the one I thought I'd left behind with the last set of keys. I lowered each chair one at a time, freed the mop carefully as though rushing might anger whatever had arranged it. I left the counters as they were. The sense of being watched pressed so close I could hardly breathe. I switched off the light and fled upstairs, heart pounding. That was the night I realized the past hadn't stayed behind. The next morning I moved through routine as if routine were armor, breakfast, backpacks, reminders about mittens and library books, pretending nothing had happened because the kids needed me to pretend. For a while, the house pretended too, but late November brought another test. My roommate was sleeping off a long shift. The kids were at my mother's for the evening. I stood in the kitchen with my roommate's boyfriend, chatting idly as the oven preheated. Mid-sentence, he frowned and pointed upward. A small, translucent bubble had appeared on the ceiling above the table. At first, I thought it was just glare from the overhead light, but it grew, slowly, visibly, swelling as if the ceiling itself were breathing. We watched it expand from the size of a coin to an egg, then to a slick grapefruit-sized bulge. We checked the upstairs bathrooms for leaks, touched the pipes, ran the faucets, nothing. The paint surface stayed smooth, stretched tight as a balloon. "Pop it," he finally said. I fetched a bucket. He pierced the swelling with a paring knife. A thin stream of clear, scentless water gushed out, filling the bucket halfway before the bubble sagged and flattened, leaving the ceiling intact as though nothing had happened. The landlord arrived later and saw no sign of damage, no damp wood, no leak to explain it. The ceiling looked normal, the kitchen dry, and I could see in his eyes he thought we'd made it up. But we had both stood there watching it grow. The house had done something and then erased its own evidence. December crept in with frost at the windows and a child's faith that Christmas decorations could ward off anything. We bought long coils of evergreen garland, the bendable kind with wire inside, and wrapped them around the banister up the open staircase, twisting them tight between each spindle until our fingertips hurt. We tied bright red bows at intervals. By the time we finished, the whole curve of the stair looked like a scene out of a holiday magazine. Warm, domestic, safe. That evening, we rewarded the kids with a trip to an indoor play place. We were gone less than 2 hours. When we came home, a wall of frigid air met us at the door. The furnace had quit while we were out. We bundled the kids under piles of blankets and decided we'd call the landlord in the morning. Morning came with its own shock. The temperature inside was still bitterly cold, and every single strand of garland had been stripped from the staircase and hurled across the main floor. Coils lay under the hall table, looped over chairs, even knotted around the bottom stairs, though to trip the first person who tried to climb. Garland wired that tightly doesn't simply spring loose. It had to be unwound, twist by twist. That takes time. That takes hands. My roommate's face flushed red with anger. She blamed gravity, the cheapness of the decorations, any excuse that wasn't supernatural. I said nothing, unwilling to give the house more power by speaking it aloud. We never wound the garland back up. We left the garland where it lay in tangled heaps at the base of the stairs. The boughs were scattered like shed petals. It was as if the house had waited until we were gone to undo every bit of cheer we'd wound into that banister. We set up a brand new artificial tree in the living room, thinking at least the children deserved that much holiday magic, but the tree never stayed upright. Every time we came home, whether from errands or simply stepping out to fetch the mail, we'd find it toppled on its side, sometimes halfway across the room. We tried anchoring the stand, double-checking that the floor was level. It didn't matter. The tree always fell. By then we'd stopped making excuses for the kids. We just lifted it silently, dusted off the ornaments, and moved on. It felt safer not to acknowledge what we both knew. Somewhere in those brittle, cold weeks, Adam, my youngest, started to complain about his closet. At 3 years old, he had always been shy about the dark, but this was different. He shared a bedroom with Ty, who remained untouched by the unease that hung over the rest of us. Adam refused to go near the closet door. I asked him once what was wrong with it. He wouldn't say. He just whispered, "It's wrong," and pressed his lips together, like a secret he didn't want to free. I started leaving a lamp on for him at night, a simple table lamp with a push-button knob. You could feel it click solidly when you turned it on or off. The first night I left it burning, I woke to Adam's scream. I rushed in to find the lamp dark. I twisted the knob and felt it click from off back to on beneath my fingers, the bulb flaring to life again. He wouldn't go back to sleep unless I stayed beside him. I lay down, stroking his hair until his breathing slowed. An hour later, in the thick quiet of after midnight, I heard the distinct, metallic click of the knob turning. The lamp went out. It wasn't a flicker. It wasn't a bad bulb. The knob had been pushed. That's the kind of detail that lodges in your mind and keeps you awake long after the child drifts off again. The older kids adapted in their own ways. Mary talked constantly, singing to herself, narrating her doll games, whispering to little Max as if the constant sound could keep the silence at bay. Ty shut everything out. He'd roll over in bed and sink into sleep, a small fortress of denial beneath his blankets. Children choose their weapons. Adults inherit the worry. Winter pressed in hard. The furnace failed more than once, each outage like the house reminding us who was in charge. I found myself lingering on the landing at night, listening for sounds that shouldn't be there, creaks that weren't the wind, the faint drag of bristles on wood as if someone were sweeping an empty floor. I began brushing my teeth with my eyes fixed on the hallway mirror, not because I expected to see anything behind me, but because I feared I might, and the shock would make me choke on the toothpaste. A house that rearranges itself teaches you vigilance. By the end of the semester, I was frayed thin. An opportunity came up to transfer to a smaller campus 45 minutes west, a chance to finish my degree and start fresh yet again. I drove out one bright afternoon to see the town. It was modest and welcoming, the kind of place where the air smelled of bakery bread, and you could imagine a life that didn't involve checking lamps at 2 a.m. I came home with brochures and a decision. We were moving. The kids surprised me by being excited about the change. We started packing together, me folding clothes into neat, flattened stacks as if order could keep us safe, the children turning empty boxes into pirate ships, racing them across the carpet. On our last morning, the house echoed around us, hollow and watchful. I walked the same loop I used to mop, foyer to laundry to kitchen to living room, silently saying thank you and goodbye in the same breath. We shut the front door and drove west with a relief that tasted like metal. 45 minutes isn't far, but hope can stretch itself over a short highway like a bridge. The new house was smaller, humbler, less dramatic somehow. No grand staircase to wind garland around, no long hallway for footsteps to travel. The kids scattered through the rooms, counting windows and steps to the backyard. I lingered by the front door, listening to the silence as if it might tell me whether it planned to stay ordinary. For a few days it did. Adam's lamp stayed on. The closet door stayed just a door. Mary started talking about paint colors for her room. Ty slept with the heavy breathing of a boy who believed the nightmare had been left behind. On the third night, the house reminded me that it hadn't promised anything. I was in the hallway when I heard it, the faint rattle of dishes, though no one was at the counter. I paused, palm flat against the wall, as though the plaster itself might confess. "Mom?" Mary called from the living room. "Did you hear that?" "Pipes," I said automatically, because the new house deserved an ordinary excuse. That night I tucked Adam in, as usual. He watched the glow of his bedside lamp until his eyes slipped shut. I kissed his hair and went to bed, daring to hope that the worst was over. At 2:13 a.m., the lamp clicked off. Adam's cry started as a whimper, then rose sharp enough to slice the dark. I hurried in, switched the lamp back on, felt the knob click obediently under my fingers. "It's just the lamp," I whispered, smoothing his hair as if checking for fever. He clung to my wrist but said nothing. The closet door stayed closed. Nothing moved in the corner. Still, the room felt watched. A week later, as I unpacked the last kitchen box, I stopped cold. Inside were the same nail clippers, the same old plastic container, the same scattered odds and ends that had been thrown against the wall that terrible night in the other house. I set them gently on the shelf, telling myself it was only coincidence that every household keeps the same small, sharp necessities. That evening the phone rang, except it didn't. No caller ID, no missed call, just the unmistakable electronic chime of a phone ringing in the air, fading before I could reach it. I stood there with my hand on the receiver, that old cold thought coiling up again. It doesn't care where you live. I tried not to name it. I'd learned in two different houses now that giving something a name can feel like handing it the deed. But in my head, never out loud, I started calling them what I always had, the friend and his mother. The words made the presence sound almost polite, as if naming them could shrink them down to neighbors you occasionally had to share a hallway with. Living with something that rearranges your home turns you into a curator of tolerances. You decide what you can live with: a lamp that clicks off in the middle of the night, bearable, a Christmas tree that refuses to stay upright, you pick it up again, a child's closet that feels wrong. You guard it with light and pretend that's enough. You keep living, because what's the alternative? The new house had no dogs to alert us, no four-legged alarms staring at corners that shouldn't have held shapes. Instead, there was only the late-night stillness, the click of cooling pipes, the settling sighs of wooden boards, ordinary sounds that sometimes hid something else beneath them. I'd lie awake in the dark, the blankets pulled to my chin, trying to focus on the mundane noises, the refrigerator's hum, the distant swoosh of passing cars on the street. And then I'd hear it. Soft, steady, unmistakable. The sweep of bristles across a floor. At first it was so faint I doubted myself. Maybe it was my imagination filling silence with memory. But the rhythm grew clearer. Back and forth, the way you'd push a broom across a clean kitchen. It was the same sound I'd come to dread in the old house. So it had followed us. At dawn, sunlight slipped across the new kitchen table, throwing bright rectangles on the wood. I set my palms flat against that smooth surface and whispered to the air, "Not here." It wasn't a command, it was more like a prayer. We stayed in that little house longer than I thought we would, long enough for the kids to build new routines, long enough to fill it with birthdays and backpacks and the smell of grilled cheese on rainy days. The haunting never fully stopped, but the ordinary managed to thread itself in between. There were late-night bowls of cereal, Mary's math worksheets spread across the same table. Where the broom once stood like a flag, Adam's tiny sneakers abandoned at the foot of the couch after a day of play. Ordinary life insisted on itself, and that was our saving grace. Some evenings I convinced myself the presence was residual, just the lingering footprint of someone else's unfinished walk. On those nights I could almost forgive the lamp. Other nights it felt deliberate. I'd remember the circle of chairs around the mop bucket in that first kitchen, and I'd know in my bones that no innocent echo arranges furniture with purpose. I've stopped hoping for a clean ending. What I ask for now are mornings. The sound of spoons clinking, in cereal bowls, the weight of a backpack dropped carelessly in the hall. The chatter of kids arguing over who gets the last pancake. I ask for light, the kind that makes a home feel occupied even when the presence refuses to leave. Some houses are haunted, some families are. When it's the latter, doors can keep out weather, but not what's already found its way in. We move through our days like neighbors sharing a thin wall, sometimes ignoring each other, sometimes aware of the other's footsteps on the other side. There are nights when I feel the air thicken, as if the room itself is holding its breath. I'll murmur into the quiet, "Not here." Sometimes the answer is silence. Sometimes it's the faint scrape of sweeping, repeated like a vow. That's when I know the story isn't finished. That's when I turn on the light anyway. In time, we moved again. House 3 giving way to house 4, but by then I'd learned distance isn't a moat. 45 minutes, 400 miles, so if it's attached to you, it learns your new address before you do. I packed the boxes smaller this time because the children were older, but there are things you can't fold and tape shut. You carry your history. Sometimes your history carries you. People often ask, first gently, then with a note of challenge, why I don't call a priest, a medium, a psychic. The truth is I've thought about it more times than I can count. But how do you tell the difference between a person who can help and a person who just knows the script? How do you invite someone to interpret the private grammar of your life and ask them to speak for something that's already been speaking in its own way for years? I don't want a spectacle. I want an answer that isn't a lie. Are we sensitive or are we followed? And if the result is the same, does the distinction matter? There are nights when I believe the presence is simply leftover grief, a memory walking the same loop through a house that no longer remembers it. And there are nights when I believe it's intentional, because you can feel intent in the way a lamp knob clicks firmly under an unseen hand, in the way a broom stands upright in a bucket at the center of a circle of chairs. On those nights, I sleep with one foot touching the floor, an old habit, as if I don't quite trust the bed to hold still. If you've ever moved and discovered you packed the wrong thing, a shadow, a whisper, an unfinished presence, then you know what it's like. You know why I don't tell the full story at dinner parties? Do you know the way people's smiles harden when they're trying to be kind but don't quite believe you? You learn to hold your story close, to share it only with those who felt the same cold patch of air pass behind them in an empty room. What I've learned after all these years is simple, but it isn't comforting. A house can be haunted. But sometimes the haunting chooses the family. When that happens, you keep choosing to live anyway. You keep tucking children into bed, keep lighting the lamp, keep making cereal in the same kitchen where once a mop stood like a warning. You keep speaking to the air, saying, "Not here," because even if it doesn't listen, it reminds you that you still have a voice. And on the nights when the sweeping stops, the silence isn't relief. It's recognition. It means the presence is listening, and it means it knows that I know it's still there. That's when I leave the light on and wait for morning.
Want more real ghost stories? Then press subscribe now so you don't miss any of the multiple new ghost stories we drop for you every day. Only here at Real Ghost Stories Online.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Modo Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Modo Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Modo Casino app today. Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spend on Modo, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Modo, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Modo Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Modo Casino.
Download the Modo Casino app today.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spend on Modo, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Modo, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Modo Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Modo Casino.
Download the Modo Casino app today.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details.
Modo Casino. America's social casino. Modo Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Modo Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Modo Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Modo Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Modo Casino app today.
Modo Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Modo Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Modo Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Modo Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Modo Casino app today. Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spend on Modo, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Modo, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Modo Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Modo Casino.
Download the Modo Casino app today.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details.
Modo Casino, America's social casino.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spend on Modo, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Modo, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Modo Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Modo Casino.
Download the Modo Casino app today.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details.
Modo Casino, America's social casino. Modo Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Modo Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Modo Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Modo Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Modo Casino app today. Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spend on Modo, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Modo, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Modo Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Modo Casino.
Download the Modo Casino app today.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details.
Modo Casino, America's social casino.
It's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. LifeLock is here with tips to help protect your identity. Use strong passwords, set up multi-factor authentication, report scams, and update your software. And for comprehensive identity protection, LifeLock is your best choice. LifeLock alerts you to suspicious uses of your personal information and fixes identity theft, guaranteed, or your money back. Start your protection today with a 30-day free trial at LifeLock.com. Use promo code NEWS. Terms apply.